Welcome to the podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. Our podcast weaves together the message and a taste of the music that we experience each Sunday morning as we root our lives in grace through worship here at The Table. More and more people are finding their way to The Table through this podcast, so if you are one of the many, many folks who tune in each week from other parts of California, other parts of our country, or even from other places in the world, we would invite you to take a next step in growing in faith here at The Table. You can do that online at our website, thetableumc.org. There you'll find links to social media and also a way to make a deep commitment to our community to express how you hope to root your life in grace, to grow in faith, to reach in love, and to give generously. If you're one of the many people listening to this but haven't quite walked through the door of the sanctuary yet on a Sunday morning, we would love to welcome you into the beauty of this sanctuary. We gather each Sunday for worship at 9:30 and at 11. Our address is 5265 H Street in East Sacramento.
When I look into the face of my enemy, I see my brother, I see my sister. When I look into the face of my enemy, I see my brother, I see my sister. When I look into the face of my enemy, I see my brother, I see my sister. When I look into the face of my enemy, I see my brother, I see my sister. When I look into the face of my enemy, I see my brother, I see my sister.
Our scripture this morning comes from the Gospel of Luke, the 18th chapter, and I'm going to read verses 1 through 8. It'll be on the screen if you'd like to follow along. Then Jesus told them a parable about their need to pray always and not to lose heart. And he said, in a certain city there was a judge who never feared God nor had respect for people. And in that city there was a widow who kept coming to him and saying, grant me justice against my opponent. For a while he refused, but later he said to himself, though I have no fear of God and no respect for anyone, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will grant her justice so that she may not wear me out by continually coming. And the Lord said, listen to what the unjust judge says. And will not God grant justice to his chosen ones who cry to God day and night? Will God delay long in helping them? I tell you, God will quickly grant justice to them. And yet, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth?
But the devil wants its due and says human life is cheap. Until we give up any hope we could ever change the past, then at last there's a ring around the moon, there's a chill on the breeze, there's somebody with their hands clasped down on their knees, and angels hold their breath for what might set them free. There's a mean kind of justice coming down.
Our kitchen tables are using an ancient method to gather together throughout the summer. It's a way of reading biblical texts called Lectio Divina, divine reading. And what happens is one person reads the text, and everyone is invited just to listen for content. And then there's a moment of silence and a second person reads. And folks are invited to listen for a word or an image or a phrase or a song that might resonate with them. And then after a moment of silence, each person is invited to share whatever came up for them. And so you hear as people share all of the different places our attention is drawn in these texts. And then we read a third time and we're listening for how God might speak to us through this text. And so there's a longer period of silence. And then at that moment, we're all invited to take turns sharing and listening for how God is speaking to each of us a little bit differently as we work together on these texts, as we read them in this sacred way. Searching Scripture through Lectio Divina has transformed my life, doing this every week over the last number of years, and the way of faith for me. And this week in our kitchen tables, a lot of folks struggled with this parable. Over and over, there was one kitchen table that was reading different translations, and they kept stopping to make sure they were reading the same text because the translations were so different, they weren't sure that they were all in the same place in Luke. And another kitchen table, I won't say which one, just stopped. And they went and found some commentaries and tried to figure out what in the world is happening in this, because it was too confusing to even make any sense out of. Folks were struggling with what to do with this, and I want to assure all of us that if you are in that place this week, you're not alone. You're not alone because there are others in this room that were there. There are also folks who have devoted their entire lives to ancient biblical languages and to teaching in seminaries who find this text troubling and aren't sure what to do with it. One of those names is Kyle Snodgrass. He's a retired New Testament professor in Chicago. So he's devoted his whole life to Koine Greek and to learning classic languages, and then he's taught countless pastors how to read the Gospel of Luke and how to engage us with folks. And he writes this about this particular parable. "I consider this one of the most difficult parables. The parable itself is brief, and without Luke's explanation, there is little indication of its intent. So no wonder people who are reading it this week going, not sure what to do with this. That's somebody who spent his whole life teaching others about this. There's little indication of the intent of this." And so I want to take a moment, because many of us read Luke 18, 1 through 8, and we just read the whole way through. But what's happening in the midst of this is that Jesus is telling a parable 70 to 90 years before the gospel writer of Luke is writing it down. And Jesus is speaking in Aramaic, and he's telling this parable. And then Luke is coming along probably two generations later in the midst of his context, and he's trying to give it a framework. Make it a little more understandable. It's like if I stood up here and spoke to you all, or Linda just read in Koine Greek, most people in the room would not know what was going on. So instead of just sharing the story with the people around him in Aramaic, Luke shares it with them in Greek and gives some context to try to help. But I want to let go of Luke's help for a moment and just have us start with the parable. Some version of this Jesus shared with the folks that he was with. And this is just verses 2 to 5. And I'm going to read the New Revised Standard Version. "In a certain city, there was a judge who neither feared God nor had respect for people. In that city, there was a widow who kept coming to him and saying, 'Grant me justice against my opponent.' For a while, he refused. But later, he said to himself, 'Though I have no fear of God and no respect for anyone, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will grant her justice, so that she may not wear me out by continually coming.'" There's a footnote in the NRSV, and the last line gets changed to this: "Though I have no fear of God and no respect for anyone, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will grant her justice so that she may not finally come and slap me in the face." Like, this judge is not happy with this widow who keeps coming forward, and he wants nothing more than to just get rid of her. So we have a judge. The judge doesn't fear God and doesn't have respect for people. That's one character that we meet. And then we have an angry widow, and she wants the judge to decide on her behalf against her opponent. And then conveniently, we have an opponent that we don't get to hear from at all. So we have no idea what the opponent thinks is just. We just have the widow's perspective and the judge who's trying to figure it out. And the judge thinks of the widow kind of like a boxer training for the Olympics. Like, she's coming with gloves on, ready to fight. And so finally, the judge says, "Enough.
I'm not going to be smacked around by this woman anymore. I'm just going to give her what she wants. I'm not even going to listen to what her opponent or adversary desires. I'm just going to give her exactly what she wants. Jewish New Testament scholar Amy Jo Levine, who we've been working with this summer to try to help us rethink these parables, she titles this the Vengeful Widow and the Co-opted Judge. That's what she calls this parable. And she says that's accurate, but it doesn't preach very well. So Jesus could have told a story about anything to his followers, like anything at this moment. Why sit down with them and say, let me tell you this story? We've got this angry widow, we've got this judge, and finally she wears him down. Then just take, that's it, that's all I got. Next story, keep going. Why go with this? I was thinking about it as we were watching the Olympics this week. And it's kind of like to me, if we get ready on August 21st and we close the Olympics out, right? And it's like Jesus could tell a story at the end of that, a story that you'd want to go and quote from Judea to Samaria to the ends of the earth. And that story might be like Simone Biles. And it's when she's getting interviewed. She says, I'm not the next Michael Phelps, not the next Usain Bolt. I am the first Simone Biles. Now that'll preach. Like, Jesus could have shared that story. That'd be a good story. Or he could have lifted up this 30-year-old Muslim American woman who's the first person in United States history to go to the Olympics and to wear hijab. And she medals, and she's in the space. It could have just been that image that Jesus lifts up as an inspiration to young Muslim American women to persevere and to be resilient, that whatever you long to do in the world, just like this young woman, you can find a way to do it too. And that would preach if Jesus decided to stand up and say that. Or Jesus could get even harsher. Jesus could remind us of the reality of how racism and segregation have forced so many African-American people to not be able to swim, and yet the good news of Simone Manuel winning in the Olympics right there. Just put that picture up, Jesus. That's a good story to end the NBC Olympics on the 21st of August. That would preach. George Johnson shared this version of it, of what Jesus might say in Ebony this week. He writes, "The first thought that crossed my head was the powerful scene in Introducing Dorothy Dandridge, the HBO film about the actress's life. And there's a scene when the actress Halle Berry plays her, and she walks past the hotel swimming pool after being told she couldn't get in. And instead of being defeated, she defiantly dips her toe in the water and kicks it around. And in the very next scene, the pool's being drained and cleaned by black workers. As Dandridge watches from her hotel room, apparently even dipping a toe in the water was too much for the hotel's white patrons, who complained. And so he took to Twitter. They drained an entire pool because Dorothy Dandridge stuck her toe in it. That's why Simone is so significant." That'd preach. That'd preach at the end of the Olympics. Tell that story. Jesus could have used any of these. So why? Each one of these aligns with Jesus' longing for us to root our lives in grace, to grow in faith, to reach in love. These are like contemporary versions of a story about Jesus saying that even Samaritans, the ones you think of as enemies, they do good things. And even merchants that we don't trust, they can go all in. Instead, he tells this enigmatic parable about a vengeful widow and a co-opted judge. It's crazy, actually, to me. And Amy Jo Levine reminds us that Jesus knows his audience intimately well. And he keeps teaching to them and talking to them about the things that are in their daily lives. He talks to them about women who bake bread. He talks to them about the Samaritans that are around them, about siblings and widows and judges. And Levine writes that if the parable cannot be domesticated, if it cannot be turned into something that neatly fits our preconceived notions of religion and morality, if it discombobulates us, she says, then we might be on the right track. And that's what Jesus may have been doing in just this moment. But to be clear, the gospel writer of Luke couldn't handle that. He didn't want to be discombobulated. He wanted to take what Jesus had shared And then he wanted to give it a frame so that it could make a little bit more sense in our lives. So I want to invite us to just step into that. See, Luke, the writer of the gospel, couldn't imagine that this could really be about a vengeful widow and a co-opted judge. It can't be about a judge who just gives in because he's afraid to be smacked down, can it? Can that really be what Jesus is asking? Well, the author of Luke makes it into an allegory and says it's about prayer. So just pray ceaselessly. Phew, that is so much easier than trying to figure out what to do with this. Luke's gospel writer is just like, it's prayer, pray a lot. Go, you got this, people. Well, that's a lot better than me trying to figure out, what is this widow doing, and is this good or bad, or who is she, and what am I supposed to do about it? So Luke adds this to verse 1. Then Jesus told them a parable about their need to pray always and not to lose heart. Well, that helps. That's nice. Pray ceaselessly and don't lose heart. Here's a story about a woman who tries to smack down a judge to get what she wants. And then he closes with, and the Lord said, because that also helps. Like, that conveys the point again, right? The Lord said, listen to what the unjust judge says. And will not God grant justice to God's chosen ones who cry to him day and night? Will God delay long in helping them? I tell you, God will quickly grant justice to them. And yet, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? So we take those cues from Luke's gospel, and then we lose track of the original parable that Jesus told some version of, and then we tell it in this framework that says it's all about what Luke desired it to be about, which is praying ceaselessly, and then our biblical stereotypes start to kick in. And we find ourselves really quickly, really easily, at least I do, I want the widow to win. I want the judge to lose. I don't even know who her opponent is, but let's take him down too. Why not? Because we're taught through all of these different ways that widows are on the underside of history, and that every widow is in this uniform place. Widows are destitute. Widows have nothing. And there's all kinds of biblical analysis and folks that spend their lives studying this that Amy Jill Levine writes about and tries to help us think about some of these things with. So we follow that framework, and our judgment is predetermined, and it sets in, so we side with her, and we don't even allow ourselves to really even hear what's going on in this. We just step in conveniently with these images of the widow. So let's go again to verse 3. A widow was in that city, and she kept coming to him saying, avenge, grant me justice against my adversary. So we read this, that she's vulnerable. See, widows aren't themselves role models. People who help widows are role models. So widows are almost always set up as a trope to figure out who's helping them in all of these stories. There's heart-tugging examples of this all throughout both Scripture and the world around it. And Amy Jill Levine writes that there is some documentation of widows seeking their rights in the biblical time. But there's documentation of every group seeking rights in biblical times. And so scholars start to then spin, and they start to add things in on these widows. One says, this woman is almost resourceless. She's probably illiterate, and she clearly lacks political influence. How did they get that from she was a widow? Another invokes that she is an enraged bag lady. Another says, and this is what you learn when you go to seminaries that are best seminaries around. These are things that we learn as we do this. The victim of a man who undermined the economic foundation of her life. For although, quote, the parable gives no indication that the widow is an exception to the rule of social reality, the majority of the population was poor, and the majority of widows were extremely exploited and oppressed on account of their class and gender. So this is the framework that I tend to read from. It's a feminist framework of how do we understand this. And a fourth says that she's an outcast, and a fifth says that she's ugly and oppressive social legal world of first century Palestine. And then what happens is we start to read this, and in order to make Jesus look good, we have to make the Jewish community around Jesus look bad and say they just crushed the widows. As though in every Jewish community they're like, there's another widow, let's toss her out for nothing. We create these stereotypes, and then we read them back into them. And the parable itself gives no indication of the widow's economic status. None at all. In fact, she may be poor, but she may have wealth. See, she keeps coming to the judge. Well, in order to keep coming to someone, you have to have the resources to not go about your subsistence life for that day so that you can keep pestering the judge. So that might just be an indication that she has more resources than most of us imagine. She could be destitute or she could be wealthy. She's likely somewhere in between. And once we stereotype her, we can ignore the actual challenge of the parable and just side with her and see what happens. And Amy Jo Levine invites us to let go of that stereotype. This happens in our own day. It happens this week as we watch the Olympics, and we've seen this over and over again down in Rio. We see how sexist stereotypes play out, and they don't even allow us to see who the person really is in that space. There's a Hungarian swimmer. I now have the most enormous respect for people who are announcing this to try to get all of the breadth of names correct. So I apologize already for the names. Katinka Hotsu, okay? That's my best I could do. So she shatters a world record in the women's 400 IM, and the NBC commentator immediately responds with how her husband and coach are responsible for her success. Wasn't the fact that she's been working that hard all this time. It was she had an awesome coach, great coach, really good husband. There's a woman named Corey Cogdell Unreen, and she won a bronze medal. It was the second medal that she'd won, and the headline in the Chicago Tribune says, "Wife of a Bears lineman wins a bronze medal in the Rio Olympics." Ouch! There's a NBC commentator, Rowdy Gaines, and he shows us how we might give a more gender-aware commentary on the Olympics. And he tweets right after Katie Ledecky broke another world record in the 400 freestyle. He says, "People say she swims like a man. She doesn't swim like a man. She swims like Katie Ledecky." Can we see a widow for who she is? Or will our stereotypes keep getting in the way? See, some judge, Luke says, as he quotes Jesus' parable, was in some city, and God was he not fearing, and people was he not respecting, and not did he wish at the time. But after these things, he said to himself, "If even God I do not fear, nor people do I respect, yet on account of the trouble this widow causes, I will avenge her, so that no one in the end coming, she will wear me out, give me a black eye." That's Amy Jo Levine's translation of it. See, it's only Luke that labels her unjust. If we let go of Luke's frame for her, we can just see her as a widow and then wonder about who she might have been. We don't have to read the coach into her success as we look at her. See, the judge is a good match for the widow. Neither one of them is a moral exemplar. At least at the start, they're well matched because she pleads to him. And she refuses to accept what he says. She keeps coming back to him because she doesn't respect his verdict, just like he doesn't respect her or God or anyone else. They're kind of beautifully matched with each other. They're an invitation for us to see the absurdity of some of the relationships that we get in and the systems that we find ourselves in. And she gets exactly what she wants, which is vengeance. And the judge, whether we find him sympathetic or not, is co-opted. He becomes complicit in the system. Because he rules against her adversary, her opponent, without even hearing from that person. So he becomes part of the problem or sustains it, just like she is. Just like in hearing the story, we become part of. Just like the original hearers have to wonder, where are we in this and how are we going to stop it? Amy Jo Levine writes, "The parable disturbs by preventing readers from a positive assessment of either character. And it disturbs again because the only closure it allows for is that this widow and the judge and all of the readers are complicit in a system that's all about vengeance, that has nothing to do with fairness, nothing to do with love or healing at all. And so perhaps the actual challenge to those early hearers and to us is to wonder about how Jesus might be calling us to resist being complicit in vengeance. And instead, to opt out of those systems and opt in to healing and reconciliation, to bringing those parties together. Maybe our task, she writes, is to resist the parable rather than to try to rescue it. by living in those stereotypes. So maybe our call is to see the widow and the judge and all of their ambiguity and try to figure out, how do we stop participating in the systems that seem so obvious right in front of us? And Jesus puts this parable in front of his followers, challenges them, and then kind of just drops the mic. Think about it. Where are you in this system? How are you going to respond to this cycle of vengeance? No wonder Luke makes it about prayer, because if we're going to have a chance or a prayer of getting out of those systems and actually reconciling the relationships around us, we are going to need to live in ceaseless prayer and allow our actions to be guided and sustained by just that. Jesus drops the mic and puts it back on his followers. Figure this out. And Luke tries to make it a little bit easier for us, but Jesus just says, here's the system. The system wants you to venge one another. Find another way. And he walks off. And so it left me wondering this week as we were looking on at the Olympics, what might it look like to witness someone moving from a system of vengeance into a way of reconciliation? What could it actually look and feel like in our daily lives? And Jesus, to be clear, doesn't answer this for people. He wants us, like we are in Lectio Divina, to struggle with it. If this were easy, this would not be the way that God is calling us to. He longs for us to live in that struggle together. And for me, I started to see a glimpse of this in a story that emerged. And it's Chad LeClos and his rival, Michael Phelps. This is the perfect storyline for NBC's commentary. It's kind of this daytime drama that becomes reality TV, that sucks you into the team you're supposed to be for and the one you're supposed to be against. It's a perfect setup for the vengeance that we're supposed to want for one another. And this storyline was fabulous. There you see, right there at the end of this is the 200-meter butterfly in the 2012 London Olympics. And LeClos shocked the world and Michael Phelps by beating him. And Phelps was set to retire. He was done. He was going to drop the mic and walk out of the pool. But people tell us that he got so upset about losing this particular race that he decided he was going to come back. He wanted revenge in this moment. He wanted to show everyone that he indeed was the gold medal champion in this. And one commentator writes, many say that this solitary prize was the reason that Phelps, who has more Olympic medals than any other athlete, returned to action. He won't admit it. He didn't want it to become personal, but it did. It was a year ago, and the two who used to be mates, they even planned a shark cage, because I guess this is what you do if you're an Olympic swimmer. You plan shark cage diving trips. They did this back in 2013. Like, they were close. And then they fell out, and the trash talking ensued, and Phelps criticized LeClos, and then LeClos hit back, and then the retaliation continued. And vengeance sells, so NBC was like, sweet, let's keep this story going. Maybe just like Jesus was, put it right in front of you. And then here is LeClos seemingly taunting Phelps right before they're going to swim this time. He's doing this boxing dance. And then there's this now famous version of Phelps's face that you see. That's what happens when you get sucked into stories of vengeance. I go into that space. I want to crush that person. And Jesus wants us to see that that's real. That's part of who we are. And that could have been the end. There were so many memes about this, like all over the place. There were images of, let's laugh about this and let's live in this together. Let's find a side and go with it. And then the memes fell off for this next race. And that was the 100 butterfly. And nobody created images on what happened with the 100 butterfly. So here we are at the end of the 100 butterfly. That's Phelps and LeClos embracing each other. See, everybody says there has to be a winner and there has to be a loser. And in this particular race, there was a winner, Joseph Schooling of Singapore. He beat both LeClos and Phelps for the gold in that race. And LeClos and Phelps and another person had a three-way tie for silver. And they embraced one another in this way and then hugged. I couldn't find the image of it. And so what if that's what it looks like to resist systems that promote vengeance? What if that's the beginning of what reconciliation actually looks like for them and for a widow and a judge and this person that we never even get to hear from? What if the widow and judge could have imagined that as their finish? And what if the hearers of Jesus' story were called to make social memes and to promote this image instead of vengeance? And so for some good measure, there was even this other image that came up, and that's schooling in 2008, the gold medal winner standing with Phelps. He grew up alongside that person, and they're seen both here in Embrace and then after the Olympics as well. What if that's just one more seed for what it looks like to experience the reconciliation that God longs for us to find in a world that promotes and cycles over and over into vengeance? And for us then, what relationships are we in right now that aren't showing up all over social media but are taking up so much space in our own hearts? Relationships that have turned us into adversaries and opponents, enemies. And what might it look like for us to step out of that cycle and to step into God's reconciling love in deeper relationship with those folks that we might still see as enemies? What might it look like for us to swim for silver and then stand on the podium with the person that we're supposed to see as enemy, but instead embrace as neighbor, as friend, as beloved child of God? May that be our task this day. Amen.
We're gonna live so God can use us anywhere, Lord, anytime. We're gonna live so God can use us anywhere, Lord, anytime.
We're gonna work so,
work so
God can use us anywhere, Lord, anytime.
Anytime.
We're gonna work so,
work so
God can use us anywhere, Lord, anytime.